In a highly unusual move, Pope Benedict has summoned more than two dozen bishops from Ireland. He wants to hear personally their explanations for Ireland's massive clerical sex abuse scandal. The meetings being held today and tomorrow at the Vatican could lead to a major shakeup in the Irish church hierarchy for what has been described as a culture of cover-up. NPR's Silvia Pagioli reports from Rome.
2 months ago, an investigation into the Dublin Diocese, known as the Murphy Report, revealed that the Irish Catholic Church had been covering up crimes by dozens of pedophile priests against hundreds of young people for decades. The Murphy Report came just 7 months after another investigation revealed chronic beatings, rapes, near starvation, and humiliation of 30,000 children in state-run schools and orphanages, all run by the Catholic Church. Bishop Joseph Duffy, spokesman for the Irish Bishops' Conference, acknowledges that the meetings with the Pope will have to lead to major changes in the Irish Church.
This is not just a cosmetic exercise, as some people might seem to think. If anything has come out of this, it's the failure on the part of all of us, including the bishops, to not do as we are expected to do.
The Murphy Report cites one priest who admitted molesting more than 100 children and another who said he molested children at least once every 2 weeks for 25 years. In devoutly Catholic Ireland, the impact of the two reports on clerical sex abuse has been devastating, and attendance at Sunday Mass has dropped sharply. Bishop Duffy.
The very first concern has to be the question of survivors and the enormous injustice and cruelty that they have suffered.
Bishop Duffy said each bishop will have 7 minutes to speak directly before the Pope and give his version of events.
I think the casualty in all of this has been the truth, and we do accept that, that the fullness of truth must come out. Everything must be laid on the table.
But victims' groups are demanding concrete actions. Four bishops have offered resignations, and the Pope has so far accepted one of them. The victims' group 1 in 4 has called for the resignation of other bishops who engaged in what it calls a culture of cover-up. Victims' groups say they will seek damages that could undermine the Irish Church's finances. The Irish Church is a big player in the country's economy. It runs 92% of the state-owned primary schools and owns some of Ireland's biggest hospitals. The group 1 in 4 has also complained of Vatican obstruction. The Murphy Report said specifically that Vatican officials refused to deal directly with investigators, saying they had not gone through the proper diplomatic channels. Bishop Duffy believes Pope Benedict has known what was going on in Ireland for a long time.
It's my information that the Pope is very well clued in on this whole issue, that even before he became Pope at all, that he had access to the documentation, that he knew exactly what was in the documentation, and that he wasn't living in a fool's paradise, that he knew exactly where the issues and the total complexity of them.
Just as the Irish bishops were preparing to come to Rome, the Catholic Church has been rocked by another sex abuse scandal in the Pope's native Germany. The abuse allegedly occurred in Jesuit schools in Berlin, Hamburg, Bonn, and other cities. This is the first time a sex abuse scandal has hit a priestly order considered the intellectual elite of the Roman Catholic Church. Father Stefan Dartmann, head of the Jesuit order in Germany, said an immense tragedy is now becoming apparent. Observers say the German Catholic Church is just at the start of a painful process that is all too familiar to the Irish and American churches. Silvia Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.
Pope Benedict scolded Irish bishops today for their handling of decades of child abuse by priests in Ireland. Benedict had summoned 24 bishops to an exceptional two-day meeting at the Vatican. Four bishops have offered their resignations. The Pope has so far accepted one. But the meeting did not address victims' demands that he force more bishops to resign. NPR's Silvia Pagioli reports from Rome.
In a written statement, the Vatican acknowledged that the Irish crisis has led to a breakdown in trust in the Church's leadership. Pope Benedict condemned the abuse of children as a heinous crime and challenged the bishops to address problems of the past with determination and resolve. Each of 24 bishops was given 5 minutes to give his version of events. And as the Vatican statement pointed out, the bishops committed themselves to cooperation with Irish state authorities. There was no discussion of resignations nor of the victim's other demand to be received by the Pope at the Vatican. At a later press conference with some Irish bishops, these omissions prompted numerous tough questions. John Cooney of the Irish Independent asked Bishop Dennis Brennan for his reaction to the victims' anger.
Already in Ireland, the victims are on radio saying that this meeting has been a complete failure.
The victims were central to all of our discussions in these days, and the victims remain our top priority.
The Vatican meeting came 2 months after the Murphy Commission report into crimes by pedophile priests said the church in Ireland had obsessively concealed child abuse in the Dublin Archdiocese from 1975 to 2004 and operated a policy of don't ask, don't tell. The Murphy report came just 7 months after another investigation revealed chronic beatings, rapes, near starvation and humiliation of 30,000 children in schools and orphanages, all run by the Catholic Church in Ireland. Irish clergy acknowledge their responsibility for seriously mismanaging the crisis. Bishop Joseph Duffy said one problem was lack of communication among the bishops themselves.
We're coming from a culture of secrecy and confidentiality, which admittedly was overemphasized in the past.
But when asked whether this climate of secrecy had been encouraged by the Holy See and whether the Vatican had some responsibility in the cover-ups, the bishops evaded the questions. On Sunday, meeting with reporters, Bishop Duffy had said he had knowledge that Pope Benedict was well informed on the entire Irish issue even before he became Pope in 2005. While the Irish bishops were meeting in the Vatican, anger flared at home over the refusal of the papal envoy, the nuncio, to appear before an Irish parliamentary committee probing church cooperation with investigations into the abuse cover-up. Cardinal Sean Brady said he raised the issue with top Vatican officials. This is what he was told.
It is not the practice that a nuncio should appear before a parliamentary committee.
In an open letter to the Pope issued today, John Kelly, founder of the victims group Survivors of Child Abuse, complained that the secular powers in Ireland appear paralyzed to bring to civil justice some of those who carried out acts of horrific abuse, as well as those who assisted by acts of omission or even outright collusion after the fact. Sylvia Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block. Today, Reverend Sun Myung Moon held one of the signature events of his controversial Unification Church. He married some 14,000 people in Seoul, South Korea, and another 43,000 worldwide by satellite. But the mass wedding comes at a difficult time for the church. Reverend Moon is now 90 years old, and membership in the U.S. has dwindled. As NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty reports, that has church leaders trying to connect with a new generation.
It's after 9 on a Friday night at the Unification Church Seminary in upstate New York. The air is electric as more than 100 church members in their late teens and early 20s open the first of many workshops on unification marriage.
Here we go, 8 days a week. Ooh, I need your love.
Men are on one side of the room, women on the other, matched or engaged couples sit at the back. According to church doctrine, these are blessed children, that is, born without original sin, because their parents were married by Reverend Moon, whom they consider the Messiah. One of them is Roderick Miller, a senior at the University of Pennsylvania who's going to Harvard Law School next year. He's not dating anyone. His church doesn't allow it, which he believes is the key to a successful marriage.
I'm not really interested in random flings with, you know, different girls. Ultimately, what I want is a happy and successful family and a loving relationship with somebody, you know, with whom I can share my life.
He says it worked for his parents. They were matched by Reverend Moon in a mass blessing ceremony in 1979, and they adore each other. Roderick won't be married by Reverend Moon. Recently, the church began allowing parents to match their children. But he says the church's emphasis on commitment, no matter what, is the same.
And I think that commitment to commitment, the idea of commitment in relationships and to creating really strong, ideal families, has certainly benefited me enormously, tremendously, beyond words.
So you'd like a marriage like theirs?
Absolutely. That's the end game.
We're not here this weekend to talk about a whole bunch of church rules. We're here to talk about what's meaningful. And
during the marriage workshop, Family Department Director Philip Shanker lays out the roadmap to a happy unification marriage. The roadmap was drawn by Sun Myung Moon, who says that Jesus appeared to him when Moon was a poor Korean teenager and told him to finish Jesus' mission to raise the perfect family as a model for the world. Moon brought his message to the U.S. in the 1960s, inspiring an army of young people to drop out of college, live in vans, and fundraise for the church. In its heyday, the church drew national headlines for conducting mass weddings and dabbling in conservative politics. Over breakfast, young believers wear this history as a badge of honor. Sure, they know their church is viewed as a cult and loathe the term Moonie. They know their parents were ostracized and some deprogrammed for following their Korean Messiah. But Renee Martinez says they had to.
Basically, I mean, when the movement was first starting, Reverend Moon was, you know, he was a revolutionary. It was just so different in the hippie era, you know, when people were talking about free love and our church comes around and we talk about abstinence. It was so different. So, of course, our parents had so many different oppositions. They had to be radical.
But the church has a different plan for the second generation. Josh Shanker, Philip's son, says today the church wants college valedictorians, not dropouts, and wants his generation to fit into society, not fight it.
I mean, I want to be very wealthy and be very successful and have a good education. I think the thing that's so similar to me and my parents' dreams, like, is to create a beautiful, beautiful family and to raise children with good character and with good relationships with their family.
Now, no one knows how many unificationists there are worldwide. Here in the U.S., estimates range from 15,000 to 25,000. But the numbers have dropped since the 1970s, in part because many blessed children have left the fold. People such as D.F. Spratt, a graduate student in Maryland who asked that her full name not be used. She worries that the stigma of being once associated with the church could affect her career. Spratt says the pressure of being blessed and so different from her peers drove her away, though with trepidation.
Back then it was like if you left the church, you fell off the face of the earth. It's the worst thing in the world you can do. One person even told us at Sunday school once, blessed children who fall out of the church go to a box underneath of hell.
Now the church wants to win these people back. How to do that? Well, Philip Shanker says the first step is to acknowledge the excesses of the past.
Although we talk universal love and the value of the family, we sacrificed our families to the extreme.
By going on missions for years at a time, fundraising for the church, foregoing their education, Shanker says the church has turned 180 degrees.
My oldest son is in Harvard Med School. I've got two other sons on full scholarships. That's definitely what we've encouraged them to do. And we hope that they can not only make unificationism great, but contribute to the world.
In this, the church is taking a page from another new religious movement, the Mormons, who are growing by leaps and bounds in part because of their economic success. And for its style, the church seems to be looking to yet another model, the megachurch.
Good morning, brothers and sisters. Welcome to Love and Life Ministries.
1,200 people leap to their feet. They fill the huge ballroom of the Manhattan Center in New York City on this Sunday morning.
I tell you right now, all I want you to know.
They wave their arms and cheer the band, then hush as the lights fall. Slowly, a single light comes up to reveal a woman behind a podium.
How is everybody this Sunday morning? Good. So happy to see you once again.
In-Jin Moon speaks without notes for 40 minutes. She's the 44-year-old daughter of Sun Myung Moon and a graduate of Harvard Divinity School. When her father appointed her to head the U.S. church 18 months ago, she focused on one simple goal, to win back the young people.
Well, it's been quite challenging.
In her first interview with a reporter since taking over the church, she tells NPR that the Asian church leaders were upset that a woman was selected to run the American church. Then they balked at her vision, a national church, which she calls Loving Life, based in New York City. She replaced the old holy songs with rock and roll, fluorescent lighting with concert lighting, and a giant video screen.
I think a lot of the leaders wanted to put an end to loving life after the first couple of weeks, but we just kept at it.
In Jin Moon did so because she faces a problem that plagues even established churches, how to transmit the passion of a convert to a child who merely inherits the faith.
We never had a conversion experience. We never made that decision.
So she did what the evangelicals do. She used music and technology to spark spiritual experiences in young people. She says it's working.
Some have called it electricity running through my body, feeling of warmth, just feeling as if they're engulfed in total love. For those kids who come and have that conversion experience, then their movement and their belief system becomes theirs.
Since In Jin Moon took over, weekly attendance has nearly doubled. The question is, can these bells and whistles woo back former members? For her part, D.F. Spratt says no, there's nothing missing in her present life.
So if I felt like there was a void and I needed to fill it, maybe that would help, but I don't.
But the church hopes that as it adopts an American style in finding your mate and worshiping in church, the second generation will carry the Unification Church into the mainstream. So don't stop thinking about tomorrow. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Few knew much about the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints until April of 2008, when Texas law enforcement officials raided an FLDS compound called the Yearning for Zion Church, or Ranch. The FLDS is a polygamous sect unconnected to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Texas authorities suspected that underage girls were being married to much older men, and after what turned out to be phony 911 calls, they removed more than 400 children from the ranch. In the wall-to-wall coverage that followed, we saw pictures of women and girls in front of a Texas courthouse in pastel prairie dresses and elaborately braided hair. A Texas appeal court returned almost all of the children to their families within 2 months after finding that authorities did not have evidence to hold them. Photography Stephanie Sinclair was granted rare and exclusive access to the FLDS communities in Hilldale, Utah and Colorado City, Arizona. Her work appears in a series of extraordinary images featured in this month's edition of National Geographic. You can see some of those on NPR's photo blog, The Picture Show, at npr.org. And Stephanie Sinclair joins us here today in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me, Neil.
So what did you see?
Well, I was there for about 18 months on and off, so I saw quite a lot. I started working in Texas right after the raid, and it took probably 4 months to really start getting access, to start convincing them that I wasn't out to villainize them or make judgments. I really just wanted to understand the community and see what they were going through and just understand a group of people that really didn't have... And people just didn't know much about them. Mm-hmm. And so I did that first for the New York Times Magazine, and we did a piece kind of looking at some of the women who were involved in some of the court cases. And then after that ran, we went and I approached National Geographic Magazine and asked them if they would be interested in following them in a more in-depth piece, because really I felt like I had just scratched the surface. Mm. And, you know, there was just so much I didn't know and wanted to still learn and share with the public.
This is, to some degree, a hierarchical organization with the prophet at the head. Did you have to get permission from Warren Jeffs, who's now in prison?
I didn't actually get, I personally wasn't able to get permission from him, but obviously that permission had to be granted from him to go really into the community beyond going into their homes and just, seeing daily life on the streets. We were actually granted access to a funeral of one of the leaders' wives. And so that was really, really rare mm-hmm. and intimate access because no one, no photographer, not even from the FLDS had ever been able to take pictures inside their meeting hall.
Some of these pictures, it seems like you're the fly on the wall. I'm thinking of the picture of the young women playing in the swimming hole, still wearing their prairie dresses as they do that. Were people, after a while, just accepting of you and willing to act unconsciously?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, it just took a really long time. I mean, every time I probably made at least 10 trips for this project. And, every new group of people I met, because there's about 10,000 people in the community. So, if I went to Bountiful Canada or to Texas, I had to start all over again mm-hmm. in gaining access and trust and explaining that, we were just trying to really understand, and even given all of the controversy around them, we just really wanted to learn, as, National Geographic is, so much of an education magazine. So, they did, after some time, relax.
And one of the things we learn in the accompanying article is that, contrary to a lot of our suppositions about who these people are, they don't watch TV, but they're very computer literate. The women drive late model SUVs. There's a lot of things we don't understand about their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's why I wanted to keep working on the story, because my own, preconceptions were very much challenged, and not just my own, but all my kind of lawyer friends that I met while working on this. I mean, everyone I knew really had their ideas changed at least somewhat about as they interacted with members of this community. And so I just felt like it was important to see that. And, in their schools, I mean, definitely in Bountiful, they have a school. Not everybody is homeschooled. They have computers there that, even kids in second, third grade are learning to use. So there's a lot of things that are different than what you would expect.
Some of the pictures, as we said, fly on the wall. Others, including the extraordinary picture that's on the cover and in I think it's rare for Geographic, a foldout of one man, his five wives, 46 children, and hundreds of grandchildren. That's clearly posed.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And it was quite a feat. It was a lot of people to try to wrangle, and it was about 10 degrees out. So,
really?
Yeah.
Everybody looks pretty comfortable.
I know. They were very, very helpful. But yeah, I mean, it was difficult. And I remember when we were finishing up, I only took pictures for probably half an hour because it was so cold. And I remember someone yelled, "We're losing the children. Hurry." And so I knew that it was time. I had to cut it short.
Well, everybody looks pretty happy. Did you have a giant megaphone to say cheese or something?
Yeah, I mean, I was, I'm always kind of ridiculous in front of people and try to make them feel comfortable and laugh. And I was standing, teetering more, on top of this ladder about to fall off. So they thought that was fairly entertaining.
They had something to laugh at while they're, so that's probably why they're all smiling.
Yeah.
In the end, I know you wanted to be fair to these people, to present their lives as they see their lives, and not to present any of the contradictions from the outside. Nevertheless, it has to be accompanied by some pretty difficult questions about their place in modern society.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I think, and I definitely think that those questions, I'm happy that they're out there. And I wanted this project to, for me, as a photographer, as a photojournalist, I didn't really want to be the one to answer the questions, more or less, than provide the setting for that dialogue to happen.
And as you were getting to know these people, did they talk to you about how they are perceived in the outside world?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they were really, they're definitely, very frightened about how they're perceived in the outside world. And some people came to me with almost paranoia. Some people very humbly would laugh and say, do you guys think we're freaks? So it was really kind of a mixed bag on how people reacted to me. I mean, some were I think that they're used to being judged harshly. They're used to, in their minds being persecuted for their beliefs, mainly of polygamy. And so, they were very defensive, but very human as well. And, hopefully this group of pictures is, at least opening up a dialogue to talk about this.
Scott Anderson wrote the article that accompanies your photo essay in National Geographic magazine. Did he get access with the same time with you? Were you guys attached at the hip?
Not quite attached to the hip, but we spent a lot of time together, and he was with me for some of the most fundamental things, like attending the funeral. And he definitely was out there quite a bit.
Did they have any input over the editorial
content of these photographs or which ones were published?
No, definitely not. And, you know, I'm sure, you know, they definitely wanted to have their say if, you know, made sure that they felt they were treated fairly. But, you know, they didn't get a chance to see the article beforehand. And, you know, we really tried to be as fair as possible, you know, looking at both sides.
And I wonder what's been the reaction.
So far, so good. I spoke to my main contact there, and, you know, I think that he thought it was fair. And, you know, I saw some of the blog entries from some of the other other fundamentalist polygamist groups. They were not FLDS, and it seemed that they thought it was not an article that was advocating for the FLDS, but was more enlightening people. And that's a role that I hope that we played well.
And one of the things the article helps us understand is that there are not only FLDS communities in several states and indeed in Canada as well, but as you just mentioned, there are other groups that are unaffiliated with them as well as unaffiliated with the LDS Church in Utah.
Definitely.
So these towns, these twin towns on the Arizona Strip, on the Utah and Arizona side of the border, sometimes presented as, virtual city-state.
Yeah, I think that was more so before, a while back. From what I understand, I mean, most of the people who live in the community are working in the fire department, are working within the local police and stuff. But I do believe that there are some efforts to kind of have that be mixed up a little bit.
And you've documented other kinds of communities and the role of women in places like Afghanistan as well. And I wonder, did you think upon that as you were photographing some of these women in these plural marriages in Arizona and Utah and Texas?
Yes. I lived in the Middle East for 6 years. And so it's very common in Islam for men to have up to four wives. So it wasn't something I was unfamiliar with. So, yeah, I definitely had that as a reference point. But I found that it was actually a little more open, to be quite honest, of the women in these polygamous communities, be it the FLDS or not, were more there willingly, which is probably surprising to some people. But I felt like they felt very strongly about wanting to be part of this polygamous community.
And indeed, the accompanying article emphasizes that point, that indeed, in some ways, other than the fact that there's this one man in charge, this is a matriarchal society.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I agree with that 100% as much as Scott, but I definitely think that the women are not what you would expect as far what you would preconceive of them being kind of more meek and stuff. A lot of them were very feisty and very fun and well educated. I mean, I met some nurses who had been to New York. I live in New York, so they had been there to do classes. And so, you know, it's not that they can't leave their communities or move around. So.
Stephanie Sinclair, thanks very much. We appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Stephanie Sinclair's photographs of the FLDS appear in the February edition of National Geographic. You can find some of her photos on NPR's photo blog, The Picture Show. Go to npr.org. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.